You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll find out how populations of freshwater mussels in Wisconsin are faring.
First, the Clinton Foundation has been well known in the nonprofit world, but in the race for president, the organization has come under scrutiny. Republicans have said it raises conflicts of interest for Hillary Clinton, and Donald Trump recently called for a special prosecutor to investigate Clinton and the foundation.
Suspicions around the foundation have heightened after emails sent through Hillary Clinton's private server showed foundation donors getting access to State Department staff. The AP did an analysis of various meetings that Clinton had, and according to their report released today, there was increased access given to those donors.
Joining us now to tell us more about the controversy surrounding the Clinton Foundation is one of the authors of that report. Eileen Sullivan is an Associated Press reporter based in Washington, D.C. Eileen, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get into what you broke in that news, just give us a little Clinton Foundation 101. What is it?
Well, it's a foundation that former President Bill Clinton started when he left office, and it has donors from around the world. It has other nonprofits under its umbrella. The most well-known one is the Clinton Global Initiative, and that is an annual meeting where other nonprofit organizations come and meet and sort of join this membership where their commitments are partnered with others, and it's under this umbrella.
If this were something that was just done by an ex-president, it probably wouldn't be getting that much scrutiny. The problems seem to arise because it was involved with a secretary of state and now a would-be president. Is that where we're seeing a lot of the problems, with concerns about donations to this foundation being seen as maybe a way to buy influence with Hillary Clinton?
Well, these concerns came up before she was even confirmed Secretary of State. In 2008, the Clintons did their own memorandum of understanding to disclose the names of the donors to the foundation. And the issue, they were particularly concerned with foreign donors, and the issue took up some of her hearing before the Senate before she was confirmed.
Now, tell us about this newer analysis that you and the AP did of Hillary Clinton's meetings, who she met with, and what and who was donating to the Clinton Foundation. What did you discover?
What we found was we looked at everyone that Secretary Clinton met with, and we left out U.S. government officials because she would obviously be meeting with them, foreign dignitaries because as the top diplomat she would be meeting with them. And what we found is there were 154 people from private interests. And of those, 85 individually donated or their organizations contributed to the Clinton Foundation.
So of the people, private people in the private world, more than half had donated to the Clinton Foundation. Is the suggestion here that they got attention from Hillary Clinton that was in excess of what anyone else would, that they got preferential treatment in a way?
Well, that's the question. Did they? And this going forward, if she becomes president, even if the Clinton Foundation stops accepting corporate donations and foreign donations, which they said is what they would do if she's elected, what happens to these 6,000 people who have already contributed?
Talking to Eileen Sullivan, Associated Press reporter, about Hillary Clinton and the Clinton Foundation. Eileen was part of a report drawing connections between donors to the Clinton Foundation and who had access to meet with Hillary Clinton when she was Secretary of State. Can you talk about some of the who here? What kind of people are you talking about who had donated to the Clinton Foundation and then subsequently met with Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State?
Sure. Well, these are people. One is a Bangladeshi economist who won the 2006 Nobel Peace Prize, and he met with Secretary Clinton three times and talked with her by phone during a period when the Bangladeshi government authorities investigated his oversight of a nonprofit bank. And he had felt that he was being unfairly targeted by the Bangladeshi government and had some concerns about it. And Secretary Clinton forwarded those onto her staff and basically referred them to the agency's top East Asia expert.
And who else was on this list of donors who also met with Clinton?
So we also have the chairman of a Wall Street investment bank, the Blackstone Group, and he was part of a group of investment bank officials who met with Clinton in New York. And the next day, Secretary Clinton emailed her staff raising an issue about a visa issue that this chairman had, and asked if her staff could figure out what was going on with that. So basically, you know, he asked, can you look into this? We're having some, you know, hard time. And she followed through.
And in what you're looking at, does it appear from where you're sitting as a reporter, maybe not a legal expert or a prosecutor, does it appear that in what you've looked at, legal lines were crossed, laws were broken?
We haven't found that. The ethics, the MOU that was signed in 2008, you know, nothing. It doesn't appear that anything illegal happened. I mean, this, again, is an issue of access and the appearance of a potential conflict of interest.
And in your reporting, as you write in the piece where you talk about this, a lot of people are worried about that issue of access and the idea of conflict of interest. What kind of reaction have we seen to this information?
Well, I mean, clearly the campaign is pushing back. They've said that Secretary Clinton would have met with these 85 people anyway. And others are just wondering, you know, what happens if she becomes president?
And you mentioned that changes would happen, or we've heard that changes will happen in the Clinton Foundation if Hillary Clinton becomes president. Can you talk a little more about what they've talked about in terms of how it would change in what kind of donations they would take, what kind of changes the organization would make?
Sure. They said that the foundation will only accept contributions from U.S. citizens and permanent residents, and they will no longer take foreign donations or corporate donations, and the Clintons themselves would distance themselves from the leadership of the foundation, and it would be renamed the Clinton Foundation from the Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation, which is what it's called now.
And I understand also that the Clinton Foundation is looking at spinning off some parts of what they do into separate, I think, existing nonprofits. Is that being seen as an answer to some of these concerns?
Well, certainly they're posing it as an answer. What it doesn't change is what's already happened. And will those people who have already contributed get special access to a President Clinton if that's what happens in November?
What questions do you see out there that remain unanswered that you're hoping to tackle yourself or the Associated Press as an organization when it comes to the Clinton Foundation?
Well, we'd like to see more of her calendars. The Associated Press asked in 2010 for the State Department to provide her calendars, and they didn't. And we asked again in 2013, and they didn't. So last year, we had to sue for them. So our reporting for this story was based on her calendars covering all of her tenure as Secretary of State and on some of the more detailed schedules of meetings and phone calls that covered roughly half that period. And we are getting more in dribs and drabs per a judge's order and hope to have the complete picture before the election.
Eileen, in some ways, this is a pretty common conversation. Do donations, say, to a candidate's campaign give access to the donors, to that politician? This is a little different, though. This is a foundation. A lot of money can come in. It's an outside interest in a lot of ways. Is this a unique story for Hillary Clinton and the Clinton Foundation that we don't usually see in American politics?
Well, Hillary Clinton is a unique story that we don't usually see in American politics. So, yes, the Clinton Foundation has, you know, such a broad reach. Obviously, the Clintons have political donors as well. I mean, it's this issue of access is certainly going to be coming up. It already has. The idea that this wouldn't be an issue or, you know, that she would have met with these people anyway, well, then, you know, why was there an MOU in 2008? Why is former President Bill Clinton already taking these steps with the foundation and distancing the family from it in case she's elected president? I mean, there's an understanding that this issue is going to come up.
Eileen, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
My pleasure.
That was Eileen Sullivan, Associated Press reporter based in Washington. She joined us to talk about a report she did with the Associated Press on Clinton Foundation donors and the access they got to Hillary Clinton when she was Secretary of State.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll hear about a new census of endangered freshwater mussels in Wisconsin waterways.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
When he was 6 years old, David Rozelle's mother left him and his sister at an orphan home in Racine. But this isn't the story of despair that you might expect. Roselle recalls those years at the Taylor home as some of the best of his difficult childhood.
I entered the home in 1944 because my mother had contracted tuberculosis. And in those days, patients were placed in sanitariums. And she was a single mother, and my sister and I, in effect, had nowhere to go. My grandmother, who lived in Racine, had heard about Taylor Children's Home. And in July of 1944, we found ourselves in this frightening, at the time, home, but home eventually, at least for me. It was founded in 1868. The principal founder, Isaac Taylor, was dying, and he was a prominent lumberman. He himself, by the way, had been an orphan in England, assigned to a poorhouse, and had somehow made his way to the United States as a young teenager, I think perhaps 17 or 18. So he's dying at about 55 years of age. His wife, of course, knows his whole story, and he speaks to her about the possibility of endowing an orphan asylum. And he wanted to create a home that would be of comfort to children. My memory before the time I entered the home is so vague, if not blank, so that I didn't understand. What I understood was that we were once again being separated from our mother. And this had happened a number of times. Throughout her life, she was unstable. She was alcoholic. And I now understand that she was mentally ill. So the road was rocky for her. There were times when she would request that we be brought to Milwaukee. Sometimes we were driven there to see her, and we might even spend a few days. There was a train that ran, it was called the Interurban, that ran from Milwaukee to Chicago. And so that eventually became the way that we were transported to and from Milwaukee. So we were little kids, my sister and I, getting off the train, hailing a taxi. My mother would give us enough money for a taxi, and then asking the driver to drive us to Taylor home. And we were just kind of miniature adults. My mother kept a set of clothing for us so that we looked, I suppose, prosperous. My mother died, as I say, right on schedule for an alcoholic. She died in her 50s, early 50s, and she died living on public assistance in public housing, and she died alone. But she had what I would call a tragic end. I guess over the years, I came to understand that was the best place in the world for me at the most dangerous time in my life. But I came to understand that this home represented sanctuary to me, and it represented regularity, all the things I believe a child needs.
David Roselle is the author of The Kid Who Climbed the Tarzan Tree. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Freshwater mussels around the world are in decline. That's not counting invasive species like zebra mussels and quagga mussels. This summer, the DNR sent mussel census takers to get a number on how many mussels live in Wisconsin's waters. Unlike zebra mussels, these freshwater species improve the health of the ecosystem around them.
Meg Jones went along for one of the mussel counting trips this summer. She's a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Meg, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So why does the DNR want to take a census for how many freshwater mussels there are in Wisconsin?
Well, most of us have, if we don't know about mussels or we knew about them, we've forgotten about them because they're just these little kind of clam-like creatures. But they are very important to the ecosystem, and they're also kind of a harbinger of the health of an ecosystem. So they're kind of like marine kidneys, because they filter sediments and nutrients that can spawn algae blooms, as well as like pesticides, heavy metals, that sort of thing in water. And plus, they're also food for animals like muskrats, otters, ducks. So the state doesn't really have a good idea of just how many mussels are out there, their density, what types, and so that's why they're sending folks out in wetsuits and snorkels and masks just to kind of take their pulse.
Yeah, Meg, if you want to sense as humans, you go knock on doors. Mussels talk more about how they're going out and finding and counting them.
So what they're doing is, the last time that they did a mussel survey was 40 years ago, and that wasn't really uniform. It was just basically a guy going out and just tracking as much as he could in various rivers and stuff. But so what they're doing now is they're going to between 50 and 70 sites, and they're going to be doing at least two locations in each of the state's 21 major watersheds. So what they were doing while we were with them is that they would go underwater for 15 minutes, and it's just snorkels, and most of the water is fairly shallow. It's up to their shoulders, or it's not that far deep. And basically, they're picking up all the mussels that they can within that 15 minutes, and then they empty them out in this kind of a flat boat, and they kind of like sort them. I thought it was kind of like a poker dealer sorting cards and dealing cards, and figuring out which all the different types of species, because there are a number of endangered freshwater mussel species that are here in Wisconsin. And then they take pictures. They kind of say, okay, well, we've got 75 fat muckets, and we've got 23 of elk toes. And then they put them back, and then they go. So they do that for 15 minutes each, and they do 8 of those, so like basically 2 hours in each section, and then they move on to the next lake or river.
And one of the fun things that you pointed out, Meg, is that these mussels, they have fabulous names. They kind of sound like rock bands. Can you share a couple of them?
Yeah, they're very cool. I mean, if I tell you what they are and you see them, you're like, oh, yeah, of course. So they're like fat muckets, elephant ears, monkey face, pistol grips, snuff boxes. My favorite were the Wabash pig toes. Mm-hmm. And if you look at them, they actually do look like an elephant ear. They do look like a pig toe. So, they're not like these arcane, Latin-sounding names. They're ones that you look at and you're like, oh, yeah, of course it looks like an elk toe.
We're talking to Meg Jones from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at mussels, freshwater mussels in Wisconsin's waterways. The DNR is doing a census trying to figure out how many we have. Meg, you talked about the role they play and mentioned they are important but endangered. What kind of things, or do we even know what kind of things are putting these mussels in danger?
Well, like a habitat loss is a problem. Also, years and years ago, they were actually collected because, this is many years ago, they were collected because they were made into buttons. And then when plastic buttons came along, then they kind of fell into disuse. But a lot of them were collected here in Wisconsin and sent over to Japan, where they were used in the freshwater pearl industry. They would like chop up little pieces of these. But then they realized, and this is like 1960s, they realized that they're really becoming endangered here. So that was a problem. But then also, they're just victims of water pollution, dams, a lot of other problems that we have in our ecosystem, and they were affecting freshwater mussels.
Right. What is at stake if these freshwater mussels start dying out?
Well, on one level, that's you're taking all the McDonald's Happy Meals away from otters and ducks and all the creatures. But then also, I don't know if a lot of people know this, but you think a mussel just kind of like sits at the bottom of the water, but they actually walk, they actually travel along the water bottom, not very fast, of course, but their foot, it's kind of funny, it looks like a little tongue sticking out of the bottom of the shell, and as they move, that's where they're stirring up the nutrients, and those nutrients that are eaten by other species. So they're a very valuable piece of the ecosystem. And I don't know exactly what would happen if they would just all go away. I don't know what the muskrats and the otters and ducks would. I mean, they're eating other stuff, but the mussels are providing a big food source for them.
So the DNR is out and under the water and collecting this data. What's next? What are they hoping to do with this census information?
Yeah. So they're going to be putting all this information together. And by the way, the Wisconsin survey, it's being funded through a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service grant. But what they hope to do is they'll find out kind of the most species-rich sites. They're hoping to get down to, like, the 16 sites throughout the state where you have the most freshwater mussels. And then they want to do more intensive surveys. But the goal is, though, is not just to do kind of a one-and-done survey. You know, like our census, we have to fill it out every 10 years. They want to continue doing this, and that would mean training citizens to go out and to do that, to keep track of mussels in waters around the state. I would assume it's kind of like maybe like a loon watch type of a thing where, you know, you've got a certain body of water, and you go out and you check, and then you report back to the DNR. So the DNR is hoping to plan some outreach, you know, this year and next year to kind of find volunteers and to train them to do this sort of thing as well.
In the meantime, are there things that Wisconsin could be looking at? Are people who live on lakes or waterways that they could do to make things better for mussels?
Well, pollution, water pollution is a big thing because these things filter, you know, what's in the water and the streams, and I think a lot of them were decimated by, you know, just years ago when we just dumped all kinds of stuff in the water. And then also, you know, people, if you see a mussel, it's best to leave it there, not to like chuck it somewhere or just to step on it and think, well, it's just a stone. It's a very valuable part of our ecosystem here in the state.
Meg, thanks so much for joining us today.
Sure, my pleasure. Thank you.
Meg Jones is a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and she joined us there to talk about this summer's effort from the DNR to measure the state's freshwater mussel populations.
I want to check out this Wabash pigtoe. I mean, that's the kind of thing you want on your family crest, the Wabash pigtoe.
Definitely.
Mussel. Well, coming up, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton both talked about crime and safety in their presidential nomination acceptance speeches. We'll take a look at crime trends and policy options for the next president. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tonight after 7, it's Storytelling with a Beat on this week's edition of Snap Judgment. This week's stories about what we do when we want to be alone. That's tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network.
First, we continue our ongoing series on issues that have come up on the presidential campaign trail.
In their convention acceptance speeches, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton both tackled issues of crime, justice, and safety. Donald Trump made the case that crime has emerged as a major threat and that as the law and order candidate, he would turn things around.
I have a message for all of you. The crime and violence that today afflicts our nation will soon, and I mean very soon, come to an end.
In her address, Hillary Clinton didn't share Trump's focus on crime as something that was out of control, but she called for reforms in the aftermath of police shootings and of this summer's high-profile shootings targeting police in Dallas and Baton Rouge.
We will reform our criminal justice system from end to end and rebuild trust between law enforcement and the communities they serve.
Our next guest joins for a look at crime in the United States, the long-term trends, and the available policy options for a new president and Congress.
Stan Stoykovich is a professor of criminal justice and dean of the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UW-Milwaukee. Stan, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Let's start with a really big picture, looking at a violent crime in the United States over the long haul. What have the trends looked like up until last year?
Well, what we really see is a decrease in violent crime, a significant decrease particularly during the 90s and the turn of the century. If you go all the way back to 1960, you're talking over 50 years of data that we have. If you start comparing and looking at, you see a slow increase in violent crime. But when you start to see a massive decrease in the 90s and a continued decrease during the beginning part of this century and a slight uptick. Now, I'm looking at Wisconsin data specifically. There is variation across the country, but the general theme is that violent crime has actually gone down.
Well, Donald Trump points toward a recent jump in crime in some places anyway. And let's give a listen. Again, this is his acceptance speech.
These are the facts. Decades of progress made in bringing down crime are now being reversed by this administration's rollback of criminal enforcement. Homicides last year increased by 17% in America's 50 largest cities. That's the largest increase in 25 years.
Stan, we've talked to you about that increase and the numbers in Milwaukee in particular last year. That the data is correct as far as it goes. Is he on the right track saying we're erasing the progress of the last 25 years in this uptick in major cities last year?
No, not actually. I mean, what we've seen is, particularly as it relates to violent crime, murder, non-negligent homicide, or manslaughter, excuse me, those rates stay fairly consistent. There are slight ticks back and forth, but we have to distinguish between rates and indices. So you could have an indice measure that's simply a raw frequency count. How many did you have last year? That's different than a rate, because we expect populations, a rate controls for populations, so it's oftentimes recognized as per 100,000 or per 10,000. And that controls for population and allows you to get a more smooth understanding about, well, did crime actually go up in a particular category or did it go down? Where you start to see problems of interpretation, and I think Mr. Trump has some of these problems, is the massive aggregation effect, or trying to look at crime as, violent crime. Well, what violent crime? What are you talking about? A vast majority of violent crime is in the aggravated assault category. That by far overreaches even murder, forcible rape, robbery. Those are all considered violent crimes. Aggravated assault makes up a vast majority of that violent crime. Now, those are serious crimes. I don't want to minimize that, but I think to suggest that there's a rollback or that individuals are, being treated differently, I think that would be an incorrect statement.
With homicide numbers, we did see increases. Milwaukee, we were tracking the numbers, the sad numbers last year. Other cities, Baltimore, Donald Trump talked about a few moments after that clip we just played. Other cities, we did see a jump in homicide last year relative to the low numbers in other recent years, didn't we?
Yeah, we did. And in fact, I don't know how much of that is a statistical artifact. We tend to find bodies when homicides, so they're fairly good, and we tend to arrest people for these homicides. But still, in the larger context, homicide is a very rare occurrence relative to other types of crimes. Homicides don't even come close to aggravated assaults in terms of incidence or prevalence. So we don't want to minimize the importance. Every person that gets killed through a homicide, that's an important event, but what we do want to understand is context. And these contexts oftentimes change, but there is some sense of smoothing out of the data, so to speak, if you take longer periods looking at it. For example, if you look at murder and non-negligent homicide, or manslaughter, excuse me, uniform crime reports, which are the official measures of crime in America, indicate relative stability and then a drop, a significant drop, particularly in the 90s. Right now, for example, the 2012 data indicates that 3 homicides, non-negligent manslaughters per 100,000 people in the state of Wisconsin. Well, that's analogous to what we had in 1974. So that's 40 years, over 40 years.
So a huge question, Stan. What do you know about why these homicide trends and violent crime trends went down so much from the 80s to the recent years?
Well, there's a lot of interpretation on that and a lot of debate, everything from allowing abortions. In other words, the theory there an economist put forward is that with the abortion move, a lot of these people who were born in poverty, who may wind up being either killed or be killers, they were aborted. And as a result, the rates went down. In fact, one economist says this was a big variable. Most criminologists don't buy that argument. Instead, what they tend to buy is the idea that better systems of crime control, better policing, and including increased incarceration, that putting people in prison, The question is, how many people do you put in for a marginal return that allows you to say it's worth it? And that's a, you know, public policy discussion. But there are a lot of theories associated with it. The most recent theory is that a lot of these drops can be explained relative to just better ways to protect ourselves, better target hardening, better approaches. I mean, for example, if you look at burglary rates, they have dropped precipitously, largely due to better ways of protecting ourselves against burglars that we didn't have, let's say, 40, 50 years ago. So that's gaining some ascendancy among criminologists. Just, you know, target hardening, and better approaches to dealing with crime.
Talking to Stan Stojkovic from UW-Milwaukee, looking at crime in the United States, long-term trends. It's an issue that's come up in the presidential race. Coming from both campaigns, we talked a little bit about what Donald Trump had to say. Here's a little bit from Hillary Clinton. This is, again, in her acceptance speech, drawing attention to the issue of guns and gun control in crime.
We will work tirelessly with responsible gun owners to pass common sense reforms and keep guns out of the hands of criminals, terrorists, and all others who would do us harm. You know, for decades, people have said this issue was too hard to solve and the politics too hot to touch. But I ask you, how can we just stand by and do nothing?
So, Stan, speaking of issues with lots of theories on how things work out, what do we know, if anything, about the impact of the availability of guns and either leading to more violent crime, as some say, or acting as a deterrent to violent crime, as others say?
Well, the evidence on this is ambiguous and, as you can imagine, all over the place, depending upon how you define it and how you measure it. And that may sound like a trite and or simplistic response, but it really is important. For example, carry concealed laws that have been around for decades. I mean, Wisconsin jumped on this bandwagon relatively late compared to other states. Its premise is that there will be a deterrent effect, that individuals carrying these weapons legally, registered, so to speak, will offer a deterrent. The bad guy's not going to know if you have a gun, if you want to rob him, so to speak, or rob you, so to speak. And so it falls apart when you start to look at the numbers of people who actually have the permits. It's only about 4 to 6% of the adult population actually seeks a permit, those that are eligible, that don't have felony convictions, I mean. The fact of the matter is your deterrence argument goes right out the window because there aren't enough people to have the guns. Why? Because most people understand, listen, I don't need a gun in my social life. Some people might, but I don't. And as a result, I make these decisions. But the gun relationship is way beyond, I think, a lot of empirical analysis. You have to look at it in the context of how many guns are actually out there, both legal and illegal. And there are millions, literally hundreds of millions of guns. Any attempt, even if you were a pro-gun control person, you're not going to be able to have the impact because the numbers are just purely staggering. We're a gun culture, and we always have been a gun culture, and that may be part of our, political process and our political understanding of a relationship of an individual to its government, and that's what a lot of people who are pro-gun people tend to put forward that argument, at least one of their arguments. But the fact of the matter is there is no clear and convincing evidence that doing something now would necessarily lead toward a reduction. That would be very difficult to know.
Hillary Clinton has said she wants some what she calls common sense gun reform. She says she's not out to confiscate guns or repeal the Second Amendment. But is there such a thing as a common sense gun reform, maybe that a state has tried, that actually makes a difference in reducing violence?
Well, again, it would be very difficult to what does that mean when you say common sense? How do you operationalize that? For example, do you want people to carry semi-automatic weapons or automatic weapons? Do you want to give people that, the gun shows and the people where they can sort of, not necessarily skirt rules, but it's easier to get around rules and laws at these areas. What about that? How do you make that happen? It's real difficult to offer a linear answer to that question. Do things intuitively make sense? Maybe they do. What do you need an automatic weapon for, right? And most people who are reasonable and rational about that say, you don't need that weapon. That weapon provides nothing for you in terms of protection. It can only be used for killing people. It can't be used for sport in most cases. It can't be used for, you know, target shooting. So there, that discussion has to occur. But, you know, this is more a political discussion, and clearly it's being one, than an empirical discussion. And I think individuals have to sit back and say, what do we really want to put out there, given our history and the kinds of constraints that we've placed because of our history?
We're talking about crime trends in the United States with Stan Stojkovic from UW-Milwaukee, looking at violent crime, safety, and criminal justice reform as they've been big issues in the presidential race.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are these issues that you vote on, that you worry about? Are there candidates' policies on crime and criminal justice that are important decision makers for you? And what policies would you like to see changed or continued or expanded when it comes to crime and safety in the United States? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. We're continuing our conversation with Stan Stojkovic, criminal justice professor at UW-Milwaukee. And we're looking at crime and criminal justice in the United States, with both major party presidential candidates making it an issue in the election campaign.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about violent crime? Is that something that sways your vote? Are you looking for changes in the way we police our communities and the way our prison system works? What could the next president do to improve things? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to a caller now with Scott on the line in Eau Claire. Scott, hi.
Hi, yes. I guess I was wondering how the crime is actually developed in your, like, ratio of, is it due to unemployment rates that we see an increase, and where are the crimes coming from? Are these people actually unemployed that are creating a lot of these crimes? Is it to do with other issues? With I'm not really sure where the crimes are coming from. That's my question.
All right. Scott, thanks a lot for the call. So, Stan, this, I think, is an eternal question. Is there a link between economic downturns and rising crime rates?
Well, there is a relationship, but that, too, sometimes is spurious or doubtful. I think it would be a mistake, given the general understanding of the relationship between, you know, economic opportunity and crime. There clearly is a relationship, but it's not as linear as people might think. What's probably more important around the person's question is, I mean, who's committing the crime? What crime should we be concerned about? Obviously, violent crime seems to get most of the attention. But when you start to look at property crime, and the FBI has a property crime index and a violent crime index, you start to look at these official measures of crime. The two most common crimes in America are larceny theft, which is reflected through shoplifting, and drunk driving. And if you're looking at crime and you say, oh, all right, I want to break that down, who's committing these crimes? What kind of crimes are they committing? Those two are the big winners, so to speak. They explain, depending upon where you're located, anywhere between 70 to 90% of all crime in America are just two crimes. And so you start to understand it that way, and you start to say, well, wait a minute, can we develop policies to address those issues? Shoplifting cuts across all socioeconomic groups, all racial groups, suburban, urban. It's a huge issue for businesses, particularly new businesses, as is drunk driving. Drunk driving, and in the state of Wisconsin, this is a huge issue. So if you're talking about crime generically and you want to break it down, you got to look at those crimes, but clearly the ones that get the most attention are the violent crimes. But they are the least common when you're talking about crime.
Thanks for the call. We'll go back to our callers now with Jim in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
Yes, I just want to I just want to make one comment and get your guest's response. The one common empirical factor that was relevant to the police victims in Dallas and Baton Rouge, the children in Sandy Hook, the people in the nightclub in Orlando, the moviegoers in Colorado, Congressman Gifford's harm. All of them had one thing in common. They were all shot with an AR-15, mm-hmm. which is a fully automatic weapon. And I understand that homicide is a subset, and mass shootings are a subset of that subset. But regardless, isn't this one area we could call or address the common sense gun control? I'll take my answer off the air.
Jim, thanks for that call. As I understand, the AR-15s in question were not modified to fire automatically. They were semi-automatic, but with large ammunition capacity, Stan. But your thought on this one particular weapon?
Well, I think the caller makes a really good point. You have to have a point of departure during this discussion and debate, and I think that's a good one. I think you're hard-pressed as a typical, you know, a citizen in America to justify either an automatic or a semi-automatic weapon, as I said earlier. So I think that as a point of departure for that discussion and debate, this is a great start. There is some commonality across these mass shootings. Even though we've seen a real, you know, spate of mass shootings, particularly in the last year, in the long term, they are relatively rare events. But, you know, when they happen, they really impress upon the consciousness of people in America, and political leaders have to respond as they should. The question is, what's the appropriate response and how do we define the problem? So I would agree with the caller. We don't, you know, we may not have to go much further than really starting with that discussion about automatic and or semi-automatic weapons.
Jim, thanks for that call. Given the rarity of mass shootings, and as you said, violent crime compared to other crimes in particular, also reasonably rare, Stan, does it make it hard to craft policy around these exceptional events?
Yes, it does, because, you know, policy is meant for the general, not the specific. And we have a saying in criminology, you know, that the horror stories, the aberrant events, are horrible policy, you know, for policy perspective, because what happens is you're defining something as normative that really isn't the norm. And you try to go after it. But, you know, the worst thing that can happen in political life is that you're defined as irrelevant. And so what you have to do is define something and provide some opportunity. But I think that the politician's role is to provide informed debate about issues of crime. When people talk to me about crime, I'm sort of biased because I know a lot about it. Crime is a nebulous, meaningless, ambiguous concept unless you operationalize it with greater specificity. So the next question is, what type of crime are you talking about? Because it's a ubiquitous term. So I would always say to people, if you want to get legislators really moving on this, you have to be more precise, but you must recognize the difficult nature of operationalizing a term, measuring it, and then ultimately holding people accountable to whatever you provide.
Talking to criminal justice professor Stan Stojkovich at UW-Milwaukee about crime and crime trends in the United States, an issue in the presidential election race. We'll go back to our callers with Jared in Green Bay. Jared, hi.
Hey, thanks. My comment is I wonder how much, like, you know, with the heavy emphasis on, like, crime and violence and mass shootings, just violent crime in general in the media, thanks to our 24-hour news cycle, how much of that, you know, makes the situation worse than it would be otherwise. I feel like we've reached a point here where there's, like, a tiny little wound, but the inflammation around it is so huge that it's a bigger problem than the actual, you know, wound itself. Like, Milwaukee, I mean, I don't want to get into that entire issue of, you know, Milwaukee stuff, but a lot of that rioting and distance problem seems to be mostly to do with people being convinced that the cops are at war with them, when that's partially to do with just that's what they've been told on the ground. It's a lot more complicated than that.
Jared, thanks for the call. So, Stan, media perception, a crime now that happens in Florida 30 years ago was a local news story there. Now it might be a national news story. We're constantly seeing the crime story. Is that changing what we think about how common crime, violent crime are?
Yeah, I think it is. I think that, you know, this 24-hour news barrage, the problem with 24-hour news barrage is oftentimes you don't have the right questions. Not so much the right facts. You're asking the wrong questions. Hence, you're not getting the right answers either. You're misdirected in terms of that effort. But there's a whole slew of academic research that examines the relationship between media and ultimately crime policy. How are politicians influenced by media kinds of portrayals? And this oftentimes leads to bad public policy in the long run. Because, again, the rare event should not be the normative event and should not define it. But today, technology does play a role in giving people access to information in a moment, in a heartbeat. The problem is that oftentimes concision and short reports are the enemy of the truth.
Very briefly, Stan, just a few seconds. Can a president really make a difference in the policies that he or she implements?
No, not really. The fact of the matter is crime is a local phenomenon. It's controlled locally. It's largely budgeted locally, except for some federal outlays for specific programs. So the reality is that local communities have to respond to these things in the way that they can best respond. It won't be through the federal government or through a presidential candidate.
Stan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Absolutely.
That's Stan Stojkovic. He's professor of criminal justice and dean of the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UW-Milwaukee, looking at crime and crime trends in the United States in light of the presidential election race. Still time for you to share your thoughts. Head over to the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.